Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, Congress works on creating new parks, but does not address the $4 billion needed to make repairs on the ones we have now. Environmentalists block a logging project in Vermont. Some say the result of this battle will decide the future of logging in the East as well as the bears. Bioprospecting, what is it, and can it save the rainforest? And in our Earth calendar, we bugle with the elk in Wyoming and take in the stench. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. An issue during the closing days of the United States Senate session was the fate of the first comprehensive legislation dealing with the national park system since 1978. The bill affects 60 separate parks and creates a number of new ones.
The most important new park is the Tallgrass Prairie in Kansas, an area that's essential to the whole national ecosystem and collection of parks. Then the Presidio in San Francisco would be significantly changed in terms of the management of all those historic buildings so that they could bring in private capital. Sterling Forest in the New York, New Jersey area would be an incredible addition along the Appalachian Trail and a very important resource in that growing metropolitan area. There are a lot of little parks, too. One is a very important historic black community in Kansas of free blacks who, after the Civil War, established their own community called Nicodemus. And then the very important Selma to Montgomery March, Civil Rights March, that would be added to the system. These are just a few of the examples of wonderful stories that are missing from the national park system.
That was Paul Pritchard, president of the National Parks and Conservation Association, a nonprofit group that supports our national park system. Parks are more than boundary lines and acreage. They also require money to operate them and to do $4 billion worth of maintenance that's been building up. Paul, we've just gone through a budget cycle. How has the Park Service come out?
Well, the budget of the National Park System, while always doing a little bit better than the other public land agencies, is not enough to address the growing needs that are in the National Park System. $4 billion of maintenance backlogs, and that doesn't even include, Peter, the problems where we have no science program in the National Park System. We have no commitment to interpretation, and the likelihood of our children and our grandchildren seeing the parks as we saw them is almost not. It probably will never exist unless we start making the commitment to properly protect the resources themselves, let alone deal with all the roads and the visitor centers and the wastewater systems that make up that $4 billion backlog.
Paul Pritchard is president of the National Parks and Conservation Association. One funding concept that did not get favorable treatment by the 104th Congress was the proposal to have corporations sponsor national parks for a hefty fee. It was developed in conjunction with the Park Service by the National Parks Foundation, an institution set up by Congress 30 years ago to help raise private money to support the national parks. I asked Jim Maddy, president of the foundation, about the idea. Now, what would the corporate sponsor get out of the deal if they proposed to sponsor, say, Yellowstone Park?
Well, it's probably easiest, given some of the controversy that swirled around this, to start with what they don't get. Nobody ever has or ever will be able to advertise anything in a national park. But companies would be encouraged to advertise in television and in print and in all the usual places that companies advertise their products and where companies advertise their own image.
And the skeptics or opponents said this sounds a lot like selling our national heritage. Is there any merit to that view?
Well, I think the difference between the people who thought this was a good idea and people who thought this was a perfectly awful idea, the difference is whether they had confidence in the safeguards that were written into the bill. The people who opposed the bill were not confident that the legislation before the 104th Congress had all the necessary safeguards to make sure that there was no tarnishing of the pristine image of the national parks and the National Park Service.
The bottom line for now is the Park Service enters the new fiscal year with a budget adequate to keep its current level of service in place, but no means of attacking the $4 billion maintenance deficit that has been building up for years. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. You can listen to us via the internet. Go to our new webpage. It's www.enn.com/envshow. And click on Listen to The Environment Show. That's our new webpage, www.enn.com/envshow. A court case over logging of a small tract of woods in southern Vermont may spell the future of logging in the eastern United States and have major implications in the West. Environmentalists say timber companies in the U.S. Forest Service want to dramatically increase logging in the East and have filed suit to stop a timber operation they say is the beginning of a long-term trend. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
Just off the trail, about 3.5 miles from Hartwellville, Vermont, the birch trees are marked with imprints of bear claws. Every autumn, black bears climb the trees to feast on birch nuts.
So you can see on this tree here, there's bear claw markings from where the bear climbed up to the top of the tree. And you can see there's different markings from different years. Here's some really old ones that the tree has kind of grown up, and the marks are much bigger. And then over here are some small ones, which I would say were probably from a year or two ago. And then if you look over here, these scratch marks, that could have been done last week. This area, which has been determined to be critical black bear habitat, and some of the top black bear biologists in the country have been out here and said that it's the most heavily used stand that they've seen in all of North America. And the Forest Service wants to build this two-lane logging road about 10 paces from where we're standing right now.
Matt Jacobson is the executive director of Green Mountain Watch, a local environmental organization. The road and the surrounding 5,000 acres are owned by the U.S. Forest Service, which is planning to log the area known as Lambrook. By Forest Service measures, it's a fairly large cut for Vermont, but Jacobson says it's symbolically enormous.
The timber companies are now getting ready to come back and start the next cycle of what I call the 100-year east-to-west rotation, where they're going to come down and cut in the east and then start going west again, and if it takes them 100 years, there'll be trees in the Pacific Northwest when they get there. I don't know if we'll get another chance to grow our forest back after that, and I think we're really at a critical juncture in the east where our forests are, they've gone through this incredible period of recovery, and we're getting these wild, remote forests with the natural processes returning to them, and we're either going to allow that to continue and regain wild forests in the east, or the timber companies are going to come back and cut it all down again.
Jacobson says Lambrook is such critical bear habitat that it must be preserved, and this spring a judge agreed with him and numerous other plaintiffs. The judge ruled that logging in Lambrook would violate a law called the National Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA. It mandates that federal projects cannot, quote, constitute a significant impact. In this case, the judge ruled that logging on the 300 or so acres in Lambrook would significantly impact bears and other wildlife. Kathleen Deal is a spokesperson for the Forest Service. She says because the judge allowed NEPA to be applied here, he has opened the door for future logging suits.
If this goes through, then that means that anywhere in the country, any national forest in the country, is going to have to take that into consideration. They're going to have to say that anything over 300 acres constitutes a significant impact. And it's going to kind of turn, what he's essentially done is rewrote the way the National Environmental Protection Act is implemented. And that's even if we just did this appeal for that reason, it would be enough, because he's turning the whole act on its head.
The case is now being appealed by the Forest Service. The lead environmental attorney, Steve Saltonstall, says the outcome is being closely watched around the nation.
This is a test case both for the environmental groups and the Forest Service. I think the reason that the Forest Service chose Lamb Brook is they decided that they wanted to make a point, and they chose a particularly controversial action and decided that which they knew would spawn litigation, and they decided that they wanted to do it anyway and to draw a line in the sand and beat us in court. If they can win at Lamb Brook, they can win anywhere, and that's why the case is so important.
But the Forest Service rejects that assertion. They say all they've ever wanted to do is improve the ecology of Lamb Brook. While environmentalists say logging will drive black bears and other animals out, Kathleen Deal from the Forest Service says the logging will be a benefit.
For wildlife habitat enhancement, most of it is for that. There are a lot of animals that like what are called successional growth, and what that means is species like blackberries and raspberries and wild cherries and that sort of thing that only grows up when the sun hits the ground. And for about 5 years, that's food that the wildlife and birds can take advantage of. And it's especially good for bears.
Matt Jacobson from Green Mountain Watch scoffs at that idea. He says logging in Lamb Brook and elsewhere in the East is a bad idea, not only for wildlife, but also for the economy. In Vermont, and nearly all parts of the rural East, tourism is now the most profitable industry. Jacobson says tourists won't come if there's logging.
We make 54 times more money on forest-based recreation visitors than we do from timber receipts in this state. And that means if we cut this forest down, we're making a big mistake economically as well as ecologically. This is just the beginning. There's no doubt that the battle over the forests of the Northeast, both on private lands and on public lands, is going to heat up. There's going to be a war over these forests in the next 10 to 15 years.
Jacobson points to the Resources Planning Act, a Forest Service publication, which shows that logging and road building is expected to triple in the East over the next 35 years. It's already happening in some places. Since 1987, logging has doubled in West Virginia and will likely double again in the next few years. But neither West Virginia nor the Forest Service could have predicted Lamb Brook. The court case may decide whether Vermont and the rest of the East will again be logged. Both sides say they are optimistic. A decision is expected by the end of the year. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Looking for chemicals and plants to be used for medicines or pesticides has a fancy name. It's called bioprospecting. The process itself, of course, has been going on since before recorded history, when primitive peoples looked for plants to heal various maladies. Dan Jansen, professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania and technical advisor to the National Biological Institute in Costa Rica, says that as multinational corporations have gotten into the bioprospecting business, attitudes have changed.
Last, let's say, 10 years, there's been a strong effort to change one major attitude. And that was, in the old days, the companies who went searching for raw natural chemicals to help with their pesticides or medicine development viewed the forest that they got this material from as sort of no man's land. Sort of anybody could go there and take home whatever they felt like. What has changed is that the various countries that are expending an enormous amount of effort and energy to keep these wildland areas alive and extant in the form of national parks or other kinds of conserved areas are now feeling that the people who do the harvesting from these areas of raw chemicals from plants and insects and other things ought to be returning a portion of the profits or even the development costs back to what you and I would call the overhead, the maintenance costs of those wildland areas.
The Merck Pharmaceutical Company signed one of the first bioprospecting contracts in Costa Rica. The contract is now in the process of being renewed. In the Merck arrangement, samples of plant material are collected and analyzed by the Costa Rican National Biological Institute. In addition to receiving a set fee, Costa Rica is entitled to a royalty from income produced by products developed from Costa Rican plants. Cristiana Figueres, executive director of the Center for Sustainable Development, who is from Costa Rica, says it has been good for her country. I asked her whether any royalties from new products had been received yet.
No, they're still not not at that stage, although this comes as no surprise to either parties because Costa Rica is well aware of the lead time that it takes to invest in research and development of these plants and animal species. And the chemical companies also know of the lead time. So in order for them to get a hit, as they call it, which is when they finally find something and can use it commercially, it takes, if I'm not wrong, 10 to 15 years of research and development. So that is totally accepted norm. In the meantime, however, Costa Rica has already profited from some income flows that have come in for these areas that are being protected and that are serving as sources for bioprospecting that have given the country a wealth of many other advantages for the country. So we are certainly very happy already with what has come out of the venture between the IMBIO, the Institute of Biodiversity, and the chemical companies.
Bioprospecting gets more complicated when plants are used that are collected by or part of a culture of indigenous peoples. National governments, jealous of their sovereignty, frequently do not want indigenous peoples to get the income and recognition that bioprospecting revenues can produce. Indigenous peoples say their knowledge should be paid for. The drug companies say that a shaman or someone with knowledge of indigenous medicinal practice can increase the likelihood of an important discovery or hit. But it takes huge amounts of money and lab work to screen a substance and turn it into a commercially successful drug. Proverity Fernandez, Vice President for Biomolecular Training and Drug Discovery at Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is deriving samples from 5 bioprospecting contracts, says they make payments directly to the people collecting the material and the shamans who advise them.
The shamans are working with the collectors in getting this information. We are not. We do not have access from Bristol-Myers Squibb. We do not have access to that information. They're collected and they're submitted. In many cases, many of these plants are used for many, many indications, the same plants, you know, from headaches to diarrhea to fever to arthritis and so on. We cannot really validate it in whole animals at this time. What we do is we take them into molecular biology-oriented targets where we've used molecular biologies to identify specific targets, and we have to be able to utilize this plant material to identify single molecules in there which either inhibit or activate these particular targets. So it's a little bit more complicated than taking the shaman's information and using it.
The strongest proponents of bioprospecting say it's a useful tool which can protect rainforests and biodiversity. Professor Jansen agrees, provided bioprospecting is seen as one of a combination of strategies which are used together.
Any given tropical country, and this incidentally would apply to many northern countries as well, but since I focus on tropical ones, I'll say any given tropical country has a big chunk of its terrain which is in what I call the agroscape or the agricultural landscape, and that produces the traditional crops you and I all know about. Another chunk of the country, 5%, 10%, 25% of the country, in Costa Rica it's about 25%, is in what you and I would call wildlands, which you would call forest reserves, national parks, and so on. In the old days, you viewed those wildlands as sort of either set aside or not yet colonized or not yet developed. I think that's 100% wrong. I think what you should be thinking is that crop one comes out of the agricultural landscape and crop two comes out of the wildland landscape. Now, immediately just says, but what are the crops from the wildland? Well, biodiversity prospecting is one of the kinds of crops. Ecotourism is another kind of crop. Public education programs, of which there are many, many different kinds running in many places, is a third kind of crop. Ecosystem services of water production, clean air, carbon storage, those kinds of things, that is yet another kind of crop.
Dan Janssen is a professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania and technical advisor to the National Biological Institute in Costa Rica. He reaffirms that forests have values that are greater and far more diverse than simply the price of saw timber at the mill. I'm Peter Burley. This week, Earth Calendar is in Wyoming, where the elk are at the peak of their breeding season, also known as the rut. According to Jeff Obrecht of the Wyoming Fish and Game Department, it's the most stressful time of year for the bull elk.
They hardly eat at all during this period. They are just obsessed, just ultra-focused with breeding. And some peculiarities were to the bull elk breeding season. They like to wallow around in mud as part of their ritual. Okay, they also try to round up as many cows, that's female elk, as many cows as they can, into a harem. They rarely eat. They become very foul smelling. They want to smell bad. They urinate all over themselves. They also, in checking the estrus condition of the cows, the cows will urinate on the bulls a lot, and they just become a very despicable animal in a lot of ways, and they run their fat reserves almost and sometimes almost down to zilch through this month-long, 3-week period where they completely go off food for the most part.
Although rut begins in September, mating continues right through October until all the cows are bred. During this time, the elk signal each other with a call known as bugling. It's a sound that can carry several miles, and Obrecht says it's become one of the trademarks of the Rocky Mountains.
It kind of goes like this. I don't know how well this will tape, but it kind of goes like this. It's a whistle. And then following that, they may grunt a little bit. So it's a whistle that has a crescendo and then comes back down. When an elk, through his bugling or through him marking his territory with scent by urinating and beating up the trees, they will have challenges to see who is the biggest and who is the toughest. Okay. And generally, they're more ceremonial than they are anything else.
After this elaborate behavior and strong-smelling ritual, elk eventually give birth to a single calf. A bull elk will mature to over 600 pounds, and a cow can weigh as much as 400. To support their size, they graze on grass, aspen leaves, and occasionally willows. But despite the many stresses in their lives, which range from rut to predators to disease, elk succeeded living a long life. While the bulls age to 10 years old, Obrecht says cows live into their 20s. The longer female lifespan is found in humans as well. Does this prove the old women's saying, men have a higher tolerance for filth, but they pay for it in the long run? Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 353. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News. The Monthly Bible of the Old Car Hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.